So here at Marin Sangha, we have a real emphasis on living the Dharma in daily life. And tonight I'm going to take us what's going to be kind of a sideways path in that direction. I'm going to talk about what it's like to read suttas. And I'll explain what a sutta is if any of you don't know. And first disclaimer is that reading suttas is not necessary for good practice. I know a lot of people who read tons of suttas and are really expert at it and don't have very good practices, and other people who have great inspiring practices and really couldn't care less what they find in suttas. But I do want to talk about why reading suttas might be helpful, and also a few things about why they might not be helpful. Just, you know, fair time for both. So what are the suttas? They are part of the Pali Canon. And the Pali Canon is the oldest of the Buddhist scriptures, and it's written in, as you might expect, Pali. The Pali language is a vernacular of Sanskrit, and it's not the language that the Buddha spoke in. He spoke in a language that we call, retrospectively, Magadha, or Magadhan, which is also a vernacular of Sanskrit. So they're very similar languages. Sutta is the word in Pali. The equivalent word in Sanskrit is sutra, which is much more familiar, I think, to most Westerners, which leads me to point out that we have kind of a marketing problem in Theravada Buddhism, our lineage of Buddhism, because you've got in Mahayana Buddhism, you've got things like the Diamond Sutra. And really, would you rather read the Diamond Sutra or the Anapanasati Sutta? Or the Lotus Sutra versus the Mahasatipatthana Sutta? You know, this is tough. So the Pali Canon is in three parts. There is the Vinaya Pitaka. Pitaka means basket, by the way. So it's just a collection, it's, you know, a pile. So the Vinaya is the Code of Monastic Conduct, and I think there are seven books in it. It's pretty big. It's more than just a list of rules with, you know, bulleted items. The Sutta Pitaka, or the Basket of Suttas, has five major components. There's the Digha Nikaya, which is 34 long discourses, talks by the Buddha, mostly for evangelism, mostly for going out and convincing people who are not followers of the Buddha to join up. Then there's the Majjhima Nikaya, medium-length discourses, which is mostly for instruction of converts, of people who are already decided that they're followers of the Buddha. There's the Samyutta Nikaya, which has thousands of short discourses. Lots and lots of short discourses. Then there's the Anguttara Nikaya, which is thousands of short discourses, but they're arranged numerically. This is the list of lists. So there's the list of everything that goes in threes, the three thises and the three thats, the four noble truths. He goes through all the fours. So it goes through all of the numbered things in sequence, all the way up to, interestingly, well, anyway, if you want to sort of get really numerical, that's the one for you. And then the fifth one is Kudaka Nikaya, which is sort of a collection of various items of prose and verse. Then the third basket is the Abhidhamma Pitaka. And there are seven books in it, and it's usually referred to as the Buddhist psychology. It's a systematized approach to the teachings. Because the Buddha never really organized a complete, thorough exposition. So a lot of it is just sort of you put together the pieces and you get sort of an idea, but different people might get different ideas. The Abhidhamma Pitaka is a way of systematizing it much more rigorously. And it's also later than the other Pitakas. So why are these suttas historically and structurally important? So, brief history. And some of this is stuff that Art talked about a couple of years ago, by the way, in much more detail than I can cover tonight. So the Buddha died in, the traditional date is 483 BC. Now there are a couple of scholars who have argued pretty convincingly that he actually died more like 400 BC, and it was more of a bookkeeping error that led to the 483 BC. If you're curious about that, I can tell you where to look it up. It's a paper by Gombrich. Came out 25, 30 years ago. But anyway, I'll use 483 if I use it at all, just because everyone's used to that. Now, when he died, a council was summoned. It was said to be 500 monks. And they all got together and decided what they were going to memorize and what they were going to teach as Buddhism going forward. Because the Buddha had not elected a successor. He did not have a succession plan in place. So they had to figure it all out themselves. And they did that. And they started memorizing and chanting and memorizing and transmitting from generation to generation. Now, this sounds like a huge job, but one of the things that we're not aware of in modern times is that these were people who did not write. Literacy, reading and writing, was extremely rare at the time. If anybody wrote at all, it would probably be a scribe in the hire of the king or other leader, and generally done for taxation or for real estate tracking purposes. In fact, it's not for hundreds of years that you even have evidence of writing showing up in India. So these were an oral people, and oral people have phenomenal memories compared to those of us who can just write things down, like my notes here, who can write things down and refer back to things, or go to the internet, or whatever. So, for instance, there was a report that I read years ago of a group of people who were from a pre-literate African culture who've been brought to New York and taken to a ball game. And they watched the ball game, and afterwards they started talking. Oh, did you see it, the pop, that ball pop up? And you know, back when they did not understand the game at all, but they remembered everything that happened, every detail, every pop-up fly, everything. I read some years ago in a collection of anthropology, excerpts from anthropological texts and articles, an article about a performance of Hamlet done to the Bush people, done in front of an audience of Bush people. It's translated into their language. And they had some very interesting interpretations of it. It turns out that Gertrude is a witch, perfectly clear to the Bush people. The other thing is they remembered it verbatim. They could quote every single word of a three-hour play. And they did not consider that at all unusual. So oral people, pre-literate people, have phenomenal memories compared to us anyway. So anyway, something really big happened in Buddhism around 250 BC, give or take a decade. King Ashoka was the first king of pretty much a unified India. He unified India in an extremely bloody series, a very bloody campaign, ending in an extremely bloody battle. And he was so revolted by this that he was quite depressed. And the story is that he saw a holy person walking across the battlefield, littered with corpses, and yet this person seemed very serene. And he asked one of his advisors, "What the hell is with that guy?" And the advisor said, "Oh, it's one of those followers of the Tathagata. He was a guy who, you know, died, you know, some centuries ago. Yeah, he still has a lot of followers around here." And Ashoka became very interested and became a very serious Buddhist. And he built a lot of monuments and inscriptions. The written word starts to appear, or references at least to the written word start to appear in Ashoka's time. And we can date a lot of things from Ashoka because Ashoka was actually in contact with the Greeks, who had pretty good record keeping and a good sense of historiography. So we know that Ashoka, in one of the descriptions, refers to five different Greek rulers, and we know who they were, and we know when they ruled. And we also have references in Greek literature to Ashoka. So this is very interesting that we start to get a better sense of what's going on historically. But Ashoka sent emissaries all over his, at least immediate world, talking about Buddhism, to evangelize Buddhism. He sent them to what is now Afghanistan and Pakistan, and also down south to what we now call Sri Lanka, which is pretty amazing, because Sri Lanka was considered to be a really, really wild place, and still is in some ways. If you know the great Ramayana epic, one of the proto-epics of Indian culture. The bad guy in that is a demon called Rawana, and Rawana lives in Sri Lanka. And when he kidnaps the heroine, he takes her to his pad in Sri Lanka and imprisons her there. And as late as the 19th century, in the mid to late 1800s, and maybe after that, I don't know, but I have references to that, Europeans were considered in North India to be offspring of apes and Sri Lankan women. Which gives you an idea of what they thought about Sri Lankan women and what they thought about Europeans as well. So anyway, this was extremely important to us because the teachings in Sri Lanka took root there, although they went through some hard times, and they were isolated from the north. I mean, it was a wild, distant place. We don't know of any communications between north and south, and it seems unlikely that there would have been. And they started writing the canon down in one reference I saw said 29 BC, another one I saw said 55 BC, but first century BC. They started writing it down in Pali. And this is in part because of a major threat to the Sangha there, and they were afraid that it would interrupt their continuity if they didn't start writing stuff down. And interestingly, the first thing they wrote down was not the suttas, it was the Vinaya, the rules of monastic conduct. So they started with the Vinaya. Now, back up north, the scriptures were written, they were written down in the first or second century AD, starting in Sanskrit. And this is called nowadays the Northern Transmission, and the Pali Canon is called the Southern Transmission. You'll run into those terms. From the north, the teachings spread through the Silk Route to China. There are three known translations of the Pali Canon into Chinese. Two of them are fairly complete, and one of them is just in fragments. So the Sanskrit version in the north is lost to us. I heard once that there were some fragments that turned up in what's now Afghanistan, but I haven't heard anything further about that, so I couldn't tell you anything more. But the Chinese stuff did survive. They're called the Agamas, and you can see some of the similarities. Anyway, in the late 19th century, it was discovered that the Chinese Agamas and the Southeast Asian Suttas that were by then in Burma and Thailand, as well as Sri Lanka, they were almost identical. They'd compare a sutta or a sutra and discover that a few monks' names were changed and a few locations changed. So most of the changes were pretty minor. There are several significant differences, which I'm not going to go into. And the organization even was the same, except for the Madhyamaka Agama, which is the Chinese version of the Majjhima Nikaya. So you can hear the similarity of the name Madhyamaka, Majjhima, Agama, Nikaya. And that the suttas are all pretty much the same, but the organization is different. Now, we know that the Pali Canon did go through a reorganization at some point and was undergoing a reorganization in King Ashoka's time. But it obviously wasn't complete yet because three of the pitakas, the baskets, three of the sutta collections were complete, and one of them had not yet been finally organized. So the news about this is that the suttas come to us with a lot of fidelity in the transmission. You've got to imagine millennia of first people memorizing and chanting these without writing at all. And then after they start writing them down, they're still chanting them and memorizing them. That doesn't go away. But they're writing them down on palm leaf books. And you can see these palm leaf books all over Tibet, which itself is interesting because they don't have palm trees in Tibet. They have to import the palm leaves to be able to do this. So the way this works with the palm leaves is you take a dry palm leaf, you incise it with like a metal stylus, almost like a big needle. onto the dry leaf. And then you brush the leaf with this powder. It's a black powder. It's made of soot and some other components. And then you brush it off, and the powder sticks inside of those grooves made by the stylus. So you get this nice, spidery, black lettering. And palm leaves only last 25 to 40 years, depending on your climate. So that means every 20 or 30 years, you've got to do it again. So that means in a monastery, you've got people memorizing and chanting and writing on these palm leaf books, vast numbers of palm leaf books, because the Sutta Pitaka is pretty big. So this is a long aside. So why would we bother reading these things? So a couple of points. One is that it's a good way to inoculate yourself from fatuous Buddha attributions. If you're on Facebook, you've probably seen a bunch of quotes attributed to the Buddha that might be nice New Age pleasantries, but have nothing to do with what the Buddha actually said, and then sometimes run quite counter to what he said. So that's a big deal, is actually having some idea of what the Buddha said and what he didn't say. A second reason is that it can inspire practice. I mean, think about all those monks and nuns. I mean, I kind of find that inspiring that these people worked so hard to convey this material to us over many, many centuries and a lot of difficulties. Another element of why read the suttas, another argument potentially for it, is that it helps us stay rooted. That is, Buddhism is not something that we just make up. Although a lot of people, especially people who post on Facebook, would like to just make it up. You know, they think of the Buddha as a jolly fat man and Buddhism as being mellow. You know, don't harsh me mellow, man, I'm a Buddhist. So we don't get to just make it up. Or hopefully we don't. And we'd like to stay rooted somehow. Now, the thing about Buddhism is his teachings have this remarkable flexibility that they speak to many people in different cultures and different places. And you can see the way that Buddhism is spread through many different countries and many different lineages. And it's generally recognizable as Buddhism, and yet the differences can be quite shocking, quite astonishing. And yet, there is still that core, that thread throughout. So what I'm suggesting is that there is a middle way between complete making it up as we go along and rigid adherence to exactly what the suttas say, or trying to dope out exactly what they're saying. We can embrace that flexibility that has allowed Buddhism to survive through so many cultures and so much passage of time, and see that as a middle way between the two extremes. And knowing what the suttas say gives us some sense of what the base is, what the root is. And then the fourth reason is just because many of us nerds find this very interesting. Even if it's sometimes questionable, you know, I'll read these things and go, I don't know if I get that, but you know, it's interesting, just on its own, just the historical aspects of it, just this sense of what it was like in this group of saffron-robed people 2,500 years ago. So something about reading the suttas, because that's what this is sort of building up to. I'm going to read one of my favorites for no particular reason, if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. This is called the Ananda Sutta, and it's from the Samyutta Nikaya. And it's short. You're going to be very thankful for that. It's Samyutta Nikaya 44.10. Then the wanderer Vachagata, I love that name. Then the wanderer Vachagata went to the Blessed One. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he asked the Blessed One, "Now then, Venerable Gautama, is there a self?" When this was said, the Blessed One was silent. "Then there is no self." A second time, the Blessed One was silent. Then Vachagata, the wanderer, got up from his seat and left. I can sort of imagine him rolling his eyes. Then not long after, Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Why, Lord, did the Blessed One not answer?" "Ananda, if I were to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of eternalism, the view that there's sort of an eternal, unchanging soul, you know, something that never differs, never varies. If I were to answer that there is no self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism. There's the view that death is the end of everything. If I were to answer that there is a self, would that be in keeping with the arising of knowledge that all phenomena are not self? No, Lord. And if I were to answer that there is no self, the bewildered Vajragata would become even more bewildered. Does the self I used to have now not exist?" Now, it turns out that Vajragata actually does become a convert later on and joins the Buddhist movement, but not in that sutta. So there are a number of parts, a number of elements about reading suttas, just things to notice. And many of you, I know a lot of people in this room already read suttas a lot. There are a couple of sutta reading groups that are represented in this room. I'm in one, and I know a bunch of people in that group are here tonight. I know of at least one other. There's probably more. So these are things that you're probably already familiar with, but I know I was surprised to learn them at first, and maybe some other people will be, or it's worth reminding. And one is just noticing, first of all, so many of them start with, "Thus have I heard." Mm-hmm. Thus have I heard. Do I have one? And there's sometimes it's translated to as "I have heard," but I like "thus have I heard" partly just because I'm used to it. And that's the voice of Ananda. Because after the Buddha died, Ananda, remember this is an oral culture, but Ananda had a particular reputation for having a good memory. He was the Buddha's personal attendant, and when he became attendant, he made a deal with the Buddha. First of all, the Buddha had to tell him all of the talks that he'd given already, which is, you know, decades of talks, years of talks. So this is pretty amazing that the Buddha remembered all those talks that he could tell Ananda. And the second part of the deal, there were other parts, but the other important part is that Ananda said that whenever the Buddha gave a formal talk, Ananda had to be there. So Ananda traveled with him everywhere and was with him all the time, and he memorized all of these talks. And he was enormously respected because of his connection to the Buddha, and also he had a reputation for incorruptibility as well as for honesty. So, "thus have I heard," that's Ananda recounting the sutta. And I find that kind of inspiring. Just going back to an earlier list of inspiring things, it's like his voice. It's like he's talking to us over 2,500 years. Another thing I wanted to bring up is that it's important to look at who is the Buddha talking to, because he talks differently to different people. So here's two examples. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kapilavatthu in the Banyan Tree Monastery. Then Mahanama the Sakyan approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said, "Venerable Sir, in what way does a noble disciple often dwell when he has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching?" So what we know about this is a Sakyan. So he's in the same clan as the Buddha, but it's apparent that he's not a follower of the Buddha. So he's probably going to tell him, but it sounds like he's somewhat sophisticated in his knowledge of other practices and religions and perhaps of the Buddha's own teachings. So the Buddha's going to give something that's somewhat advanced, but not what he would say to the monks or to his senior disciples. Here's another example. And this is one that starts, "I have heard." This is the translation I'm reading here, but I think the other translation is, "Thus have I heard. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying in the Kuru country. Now there is a town of the Kurus called Kamasadama. There the Blessed One addressed the monks. Monks, he said. This is the beginning of one of the really important suttas, the Satipatthana Sutta. And there are others where he talks to townspeople. There's one where he, or several where he talks to the local king. So this is interesting because sometimes you get these odd suttas where the usual things the Buddha says are in an odd order, where or they're juxtaposed in a surprising way. And what scholars have assumed, and I think they make a good argument, is that what he's doing is he's not talking to his own monks. You know, you look at the heading, it's generally he's talking to a group of Brahmins, which is sort of a generic word for mendicant holy people. So he's talking to a bunch of holy people, and it's clear that what he's doing, or scholars argue this, and I think they make a convincing case, what he's doing is he is addressing beliefs of theirs. So he is using their vocabulary to sort of do kind of a spiritual jujitsu on their belief system. And he was very effective at that. And I'm not going to go into examples, but it can be quite a bit of fun reading some of the ones where he does that. So who he addresses, who he talks to, is quite significant. So I'm going to read one sutta because it illustrates a couple of things I want to bring up. This is called The Leash. And it's an excerpt. The Buddha's talking to a bunch of monks, so I'll give that away already. Just as a dog tied by a leash to a post keeps running around and circling around that very post, in the same way an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person assumes form to be the self, or the self as possessing form, or form as in the self, or the self as in form. He assumes feeling to be the self, or the self as possessing feeling, or feeling as in the self, or the self as in feeling. He assumes perception to be the self, or the self as possessing perception, or perception as in the self, or the self as in perception. He assumes fabrications, this is mental fabrications, to be the self, or the self as possessing fabrications, or fabrications as in the self, or the self as in fabrications. He assumes consciousness to be the self, or the self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as in the self, or the self as in consciousness. He keeps running around and circling that very form. He keeps running around and circling that very feeling. He keeps running around and circling that very perception. He keeps running around and circling around those very fabrications. He keeps running around and circling around that very consciousness. He is not set loose from form, not set loose from feeling, not set loose from perception, not set loose from fabrications, not set loose from consciousness. He is not set loose from birth, aging, and death, from sorrows, lamentations, pain, distresses, and despairs. He is not set loose, I tell you, from suffering and stress. So thank you for your patience. So there are a couple of things to point out. One is the repetition, the mnemonic structure. It's easy to memorize these things that are repetitive. It can give you a little bit of time to remember what the next important word is. When you're reading a sutta, the repetitions are usually replaced by ellipses, three dots in a row, after the first instance. So otherwise, the Majjhima Nikaya is about this thick. It's a big book. You wouldn't want to throw it at anybody. And it would be about two or three times bigger if it had all the repetitions instead of the ellipses. So when you're reading it in the group, which I recommend, you're probably going to skip over the repetitions because you just don't have enough time. And this is not one of the worst examples of repetitions. There are two suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya that are back-to-back that are medium-sized, as you'd expect, and they are identical except that there's one word, every instance of which is a different word in the second version of it. That's the only difference. And I forget what the words are, but I was too lazy to look it up. So the second thing is that there are certain aspects of the suttas that you could call boilerplate that are repeated over and over again in different places. Like every time the Buddha refers to First Jhana, it'll have pretty much the same text. Sometimes there are variations, but it'll have the same text talking about jhana. In this one that I just read, there isn't boilerplate, but you start to recognize what he's referring to. And in this one, he's referring to form, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness. So a bunch of you already know what this is. It's the five aggregates. So when you know it, oh, the five aggregates, I know about those. I can look them up somewhere else. There's a ton of material about the five aggregates in the various suttas. So you start to recognize these bits. You start to recognize the Four Noble Truths when they pop up without being labeled the Four Noble Truths. Then the other thing that I want to bring up is metaphors, because as Stephen Batchelor has said, there's really nobody else at the time using these brilliant metaphors. In fact, metaphors, the way the Buddha uses them, don't show up for hundreds of years after the Buddha's time. So this is one of the things that really makes it very convincing that the Buddha was a single person and not a committee or not some later group of people. His voice is so distinctive and so unusual for his time. You know, we have so many metaphors. We use the second arrow a lot. This is such a convenient one. And the one that we just had about the dog running around on a leash tied to a post. I wanted to read this one just because it's kind of a cool... And we've got time and I'm holding up, okay? On one occasion, the blessed... This is the Fina Sutta, foam. It's translated by Tanisaro Bhikkhu. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying among the Ayodhians on the banks of the Ganges River. There he addressed the monks. Monks, suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down this Ganges River, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examine it, it would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance would there be in a glob of foam? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any form that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in form? Now suppose that in autumn, when it's raining in fat, heavy drops, a water bubble were to appear and disappear on the water, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, dot, 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 it would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance would there be in a water bubble? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any feeling that is past, future, or present. Dot, dot, dot. Now, suppose that in the last month of the hot season, a mirage were shimmering, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, dot, 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 it would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance would there be in a mirage? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any perception, dot, dot, dot. Now, suppose that a man desiring heartwood, in quest of heartwood, seeking heartwood, were to go into the forest carrying a sharp axe. There he would see a large banana tree, straight, young, of enormous height. He would cut it at the root, and having cut it at the root, would chop off the top. Having chopped off the top, he would peel away the outer skin. Peeling away the outer skin, he wouldn't even find sapwood, to say nothing of heartwood. Then a man with good eyesight would see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, dot, 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 we're talking about fabrications. You can guess that there's not a whole lot of solid stuff inside of a banana tree. Now suppose that a magician or magician's apprentice were to display a magic trick at a major intersection, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, dot, 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 it would appear empty, void, without substance. Dot, dot, dot. In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any consciousness that is, dot, dot, dot. I really like this one because it sort of gives a little bit of what life was like at the time. You get an image of a guy going out and, you know, of maybe a story of a fool that goes out chopping down a banana tree looking for heartwood. But, you know, magic trick performers at crossroads. You know, I like this kind of snapshot of life 2,500 years ago. Seeing thus the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones grows disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrications, disenchanted with consciousness. Disenchanted, he grows dispassionate. Through dispassion, he's released. With released, there's the knowledge released. He discerns that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is nothing further for this world. So, did we recognize the topic again? The aggregates, exactly. So another thing about reading the suttas that gets quite tricky, I think, is evaluating them. I mean, we know that there are some additions. Most of the corruptions to the suttas are, I think, Venerable Anālayo argues that they are additions rather than deletions. I saw an argument once that the agamas, which have smaller suttas in many cases than the Pali Canon, somebody argued, oh, well, they just had trouble translating this passage, so they left it out. And I don't think that's a good argument, because I've read the passages that they left out, and they were simple passages that were very similar to other passages that they didn't leave out. So it's not a sensible argument. The Venerable Anālayo makes the argument that what so often happens is if you're teaching a particular sutta, you're often likely to take a digression and talk about some related element. You know, if you talk about the Anapanasati Sutta, you're probably going to talk about some of the elements of other suttas. So, for instance, the Anapanasati talks about the seven factors of awakening. That might have been added later, because, of course, it would have been very natural to bring up the seven factors of awakening in that sutta. So I know I'm getting a little detailed here. Sorry. But so we know that there are some additions, and we know that there are, even recently there have been some additions. There was a sutta called the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, which means the big Satipatthana Sutta. Maha is just, it means big. It's a modifier similar to, Gandhi was given the title Mahatma, which just means big soul or great soul. Atma is Sanskrit for Atta or Atman or soul. And Maha is big, so big soul. So in 1957, a council called in Southeast Asian lineage of the Theravada lineage, in 1957, they decided that the Maha Satipatthana Sutta really was the Satipatthana Sutta. And so when you get, and it's not that it's a bad sutta, it's got some really interesting stuff in it, but if you get a copy of the Satipatthana Sutta from some publishers, you look at it, and it's very different from the one in Venerable Anālayo's book, or in some of the other books, and you wonder what the hell's going on here. And it's really because it's the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. There are a couple of other suttas that are like sort of blatant examples of things that were probably added later. One of my favorites is one, or favorites because it's so funny, is one that talks about the 31 signs. Was it 31 or 32?
32.
All right, 32 signs of the enlightened one. And it's a list of 32 signs. There are things like he's got a bump on the top of his head, he's got a really thick neck, whenever he turns towards somebody, he turns his whole body. And then it's got some very strange ones, like that he can fully retract his penis into his body. That's kind of, ew. And yeah, right. Didn't need to know that, did we? And then another one is that he can touch his forehead with his tongue. So the jokes just write themselves here. And I only know of this one. This is a very influential sutta because there are a lot of sculptures that show certain aspects of this. Not that one. But I know of only one place where this occurs in the sutta collection. So it's very likely that this was a set of symbols. And Stephen Batchelor makes this argument. It's a set of symbols of an enlightened being from some other cult that we don't have any other trace of. So it is clear that this is some kind of attempt to win over followers of somebody else. They probably had somebody that they were expecting, perhaps a messianic figure, and us Buddhists were making the argument, oh, here he is. You know, here's the 31, 32 symbols that prove that here's your guy. There's another one that I like a lot that I couldn't find it, so I can't give you a reference right offhand. Where one of, this is an attendant, a personal attendant of the Buddha from before Ananda took over that position. And he was grumpy for some reason, and he left the Sangha and he went to a local ruler to sort of rat out the Buddha. And he said, this Buddha, he's a hoax. He says that he's not a deity, he's not a god. Second, he apparently has no magical powers. And third, all he claims to do is teach the end of suffering. Yeah. So, and then when told about this, the Buddha sort of laughs and said, well, doesn't laugh. I think of him as laughing, but he says to the guy who reports it, yeah, everything he says is true. I'm not a deity. I have no magic tricks, and I only teach suffering and the end of suffering. But then he goes into a long list of magic tricks that he can do. You know, see past lives and walk through walls and things like that. I don't remember the list, but it really looks like, especially given the tone of the earlier one, that this is a later edition. And then there's another one has the Buddha announcing that basically a story is that the town drunk has actually achieved stream entry, which is a very important level of development in the spiritual path. And the other people say something like, oh, come on, you got to be kidding. And the Buddha says, yeah, he's a stream enterer. So this is one of those things where how do you make these judgments about what's fake and what isn't, or what's an addition or what's not? And one of the arguments is this thing about the town drunk being a stream enterer, who would that benefit if you added that? Who would want to add that? What would they get from it? Unless it was sort of like the town brewery association or something like that. Otherwise, there's nobody who would profit from it. Whereas some of the others, you can sort of guess a reason, like the 32 magical signs of the Buddha may well be to win over adherents of another sect. There's a danger, of course, because we tend to like the suttas that we like, that speak to us. Well, I read the Ananda Sutta earlier about Vajragata and asking, is there a self, is there not a self? That might not have had a whole lot of meaning to people in the Buddhist time. We don't know. I don't think we have any way of telling. But it really gets us. We love that sort of ambivalence, or the rejecting the dichotomy and looking for the middle way. I think it sounds authentic, but I'm a Westerner 2,500 years after the Buddha's time. I could be wrong. So could all of the scholars be wrong? Another aspect of this, another warning, is that we don't want to reject wisdom just because it postdates the Buddha. That is, a lot of our practice actually comes from the Suttamaga, which is 5th century AD. There are people, including Stephen Batchelor and other scholars, who argue that really Theravada Buddhism is more about the Visuddhimagga than it is about the Pali Canon. I'm not sure I buy that, but it's certainly hugely influential. A lot of things that we talk about often, a lot of the structural stuff about the Brahmaviharas, the near and far enemies, comes later than the canon. Things like the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections, they're all mentioned in the suttas, but nowhere is there a list of all 10 laid out as the 10 perfections. So we can learn a lot from Zen, Vajrayana, and other Mahayana lineages. And teachers that you've heard have borrowed. We use concepts like don't know mind a lot. We have a lot of borrowings from Zen because they also speak to us. Now, if you're interested in reading suttas, there are a lot of really good resources out there. The most important that I can think of offhand, the most easily available, is a website called accesstoinsight.org. It's also ati.org, and you can get an app for your iPhone or your iPad. I recommend it heartily. It's a very good way of looking things up. There's a ton of suttas on there, and also a lot of really good articles written by people like Tanisaro Bhikkhu. Another good book is one by Bhikkhu Bodhi called In the Buddha's Words. It's excerpts from suttas. It's easier to read. There's a good commentary at the beginning of each chapter. It's organized in a way that makes sense. Our sutta reading group spent a couple of years reading those excerpts, going through it. We got a lot out of it. Another big collection, I think there are 6 volumes. It's called A Handful of Leaves, and Tanisaro Bhikkhu is the translator. And that's got a lot of great stuff in it. It's one of those things where if you go visit a monastery, they'll give you a big stack of these volumes. Getting them can be a little bit hard because they're free, and free things are hard to come by. I think actually they're now available on Amazon. You know, you pay for shipping or something, but for a long time, you had to go to a monastery to get these. And then the other thing that I'd recommend is sutta study groups. It's really hard to stick with reading suttas. You know, they can get really dry. It can be really tough. And also, sometimes some of them are quite baffling. So, yeah, you can maybe look them up and find some annotations or things like that. But discussing them can really help. And really help also, in what way does this apply to my practice? How can I relate to this in other than an academic way? And one last observation. Talked earlier about the Buddha's wonderful metaphors, and one of the metaphors that he uses is that of a raft. That the Dharma itself is just, it's like a raft. It's to get across a river to the other side. You know, you build the raft and then you use it to get to the other side of the river. So there's no point in sitting around and worshiping the raft. That's not going to get you anywhere. And yet a lot of people do that. And on the other side, once you get across the river, you don't carry it around with you. And he makes this point in the sutta, is you abandon the raft. You're on the other side of the river. The raft no longer has a purpose. It's really a radical thing to say, that once you're enlightened, the Dharma no longer has a purpose. So what he's saying is, don't cling to the raft. It's a conveyance for river crossings. And it's interesting to remember that the Buddha did not cross on that raft. He did not cross using an established Dharma. He became enlightened, and he found a way to articulate that path to other people, to help other people, which is an act of tremendous generosity. So the Dharma itself is an impermanent fabrication and not a subject for idolatry. Doesn't keep me from being interested in it, and I'm happy to follow it, but I'm also willing to see it as being impermanent itself. And I think it's important to remember the measure of your practice is not your knowledge of suttas. It's this: are you causing less suffering? Reading suttas helps you cause less suffering? Fine. If it doesn't, that's fine too. So we have just a few minutes. Does anybody want to? I know a lot of people in here have a lot of experience reading suttas. Does anybody want to say anything about their sutta reading experience? Anything they'd like to add? And I'm going to ask that people use the microphone.
I can talk really loud. I just wanted to say I just wanted to say about the brewery story.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea that he was trying to say that anybody could become a string enterer. That if even the drum could do it, mm-hmm. so could you. That's what occurred to me.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good interpretation. And it also means that he is rejecting a kind of a hierarchy.
Exactly.
Or orthodoxy.
Didn't have to spend 8 or 10 years.
Right. And it yeah, a lot of his followers found this shocking when he said that. Anyone else?
I'm sure everybody's already heard of the book The Island. It has the suttas and then the explanation, and that's really a way that I like to do it. Because otherwise, I don't think I'd stay interested.
Yes. That's The Island by Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano. It's focused on enlightenment. The island is a metaphor often used for awakening.
I was just going to say that I just started participating in a Sutta study group online with Shala Catherine. It's fascinating because this particular study group is on the numerical discourses, and there are people from all over the world in the group, so probably about 20 people. And we look at suttas that are all on a specific topic each month. It's kind of a neat way to study the suttas.
Yeah, that's great. Well, one of the nice things about the Samyutta Nikaya is that it's also grouped by topics rather than by numbers. So if you want to see a whole bunch of stuff on the seven awakening factors, you'll see a row of small suttas all in one place. Anyone else? Okay. Linda?
One of the things I've appreciated about learning to chant the suttas is that even the English translations are almost identical, and it does, it kind of strengthens my faith that these words are true, that they come down through our lineage, because even the translations are just about identical. And it's nice because you could listen to different chants or chant along to different chants from different groups, and you immediately feel you're right at home.
Yeah, a connection. I plug the use of ellipses in reading these aloud, but sometimes it really is nice to read all the repetitions. And it's kind of hard to do that sometimes with the ellipses because it's hard to figure out what's being repeated. In fact, the ones that I read aloud that had repetition, I had to edit and figure out how to restore all the repetitions. And sometimes doing the repetitions gives you that rhythmic sense that it has, that can be quite compelling.